Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. On today's show, we are discussing a topic that is inappropriate for children and might be triggering for some of you. We're talking about a new book called All the President's Women, Donald Trump and the Making of a Predator. It's by journalist Barry Levine and today's guest, journalist Monique Elfazi. Barry Levine says the idea for the book came to him in the spring of 2018 as the Stormy Daniels hush money scandal was exploding. Amid the headlines about Donald Trump's behavior with women in recent years, he wanted to go back decades earlier and connect the dots. His co-author, Monique Elfazi, wrote the narrative while he chased down sources. In an interview with Bild, Barry Levine says the instances of predatory behavior he found was staggering. He said, quote, "I had no idea when we began this research that we would find so many incidents," end quote. He said Monique Elfazi made him see the larger picture of why Donald Trump's actions helped catalyze the Me Too movement and helped revitalize women's activism. In All the President's Women, they detail 67 accusations against Trump, including a disturbing attack on a woman at Mar-a-Lago and an incident at a private Manhattan sex club involving a teenage girl. They also write about Trump's predatory behavior at fashion shows and beauty pageants. 12 women share their stories for the very first time. All of the stories share a pattern, and they were all corroborated. Joining us to talk about their findings is Monique Elfazi, a Paris-based journalist and author of God and Country, How Evangelicals Have Become America's New Mainstream. She is co-author of All the President's Women. Monique's writing has appeared in a number of publications, including The New York Times, The Guardian, and The Washington Post. And Monique Elfazi joins us in studio. Hi, Monique. Thank you so much for coming in.
Hi. Thanks for having me.
Well, thank you for writing this book. It was really hard to read it. And I have to say, when I first saw the title, I thought, is this a serious book? And then I read about your background, because you're a very serious journalist. This is not really something you spend much time writing about.
No.
And that's why I decided that we wanted to invite you on.
I'm so glad you did. Thank you.
Yeah. So I mentioned that Barry reached out to you, but why ultimately did you decide to work with him? Because you said you were conflicted at first.
I wasn't really conflicted. I didn't want to do it. And I asked them to give me a weekend to think about it. And I spent some time thinking about, I mean, I think like everybody, I'd heard these stories. I knew this. I thought, do I really want to immerse myself in this? But I had been thinking for a few years about the idea of complicity and about how silence is complicity. And I also have two teenage sons. And I'm always telling them, if you see something, you have a responsibility to stand up and confront it if you think it's wrong. And I thought, having been approached for this book, if I now walk away, that makes me complicit in the silencing of women. And I couldn't do it.
I was really struck when you both were interviewed by Bild, when Barry said the instances of the behavior, the predatory behavior that he found, was absolutely staggering. He said he had no idea that he would find so many incidents.
Yeah. I mean, there are, I think, 67 documented instances of the book. And we know there are so many more out there. I mean, there are so many women who are under NDA who couldn't talk to us. So I really, unfortunately, believe this is just the tip of the iceberg.
Wow. Talk about what went on behind the scenes in finding these women. 12 women shared their stories for the very first time. So what went on how did you find them all?
I mean, a lot of it was just shoe leather reporting. And Barry had been an investigative journalist in New York for a long time. And, you know, Trump lived in New York. So he was a known quantity to many, many journalists in New York. And, you know, there have always been, like with any of these people, there are stories and rumors that circulate. And it's just a question of connecting the dots. You talk to one person who says he heard this or she heard this. And, you know, and one of the stories that emerged from that is, to me, the most emblematic story in the book. There's a woman named Karen Johnson who was from Florida and said that Trump literally grabbed her where he said he grabbed women in the Access Hollywood tape at a party at Mar-a-Lago. And Barry found that because he had interviewed somebody else in New York who said, you know, I have a friend who had an encounter who was assaulted by him. And, you know, Barry tracked her down and spent months trying to gain her confidence. And, you know, eventually she spoke to him. And that was really the process throughout the book. And he also had a team of reporters, and in specific, two other women who went out and did a lot of these interviews. And I think that was very important, too. I think, you know, the fact that the other reporters were women helped.
Right. And these stories that women shared with you were corroborated.
Right. We looked for we looked for women who at the time confided in another friend, or, I mean, women, as we all know, don't immediately go and report, and they often blame themselves. But many women will turn to a friend or a spouse or a parent and say, oh, my gosh, this thing just happened to me. And so we not only spoke to the women, but we spoke to the women that they confided in at the times of the incidents.
You also found patterns in all of these stories.
Yeah, really strong patterns. And what's interesting is we heard stories that are not in the book because they didn't fit patterns. So the stories we put in the book, we felt confident in because they all match certain patterns. One of the patterns we saw, and they're all disturbing patterns. I was going to say this is the most disturbing, but they all are disturbing. One of the patterns we saw that emerged very early on in his life was kind of a penchant for young girls. He seems to really like a girl around the age of 15. And we have stories of him going behind the scenes at fashion shows and walking in on young models when they're changing and at beauty pageants. And there are several stories like that. There's an allegation of rape against him. A young woman, or a woman now, said that, who was a Jane Doe, she went by the name Katie Johnson, said that he raped her at Jeffrey Epstein's mansion when she was 13. Mm. But one of the things that's interesting to me about this teenage pattern is he starts to talk about Ivanka in sexualized terms when she's about 15 also.
And the other thing that struck me is so many of the women said he told them, you look just like my daughter Ivanka.
So many. Right. And he was, you know, there was this one fashion show, beauty pageant that he was at, and Ivanka was there. And he was, we have it in the book, he's sitting next to, I think, a former judge or one of the judges. And he turns to her and says, look at my daughter, isn't she hot? And the woman didn't know what to say. I mean, it was incredibly inappropriate. And there are many instances he was on The View saying if he wasn't her father, he'd be dating her. I mean, it was common practice for him to talk about her in these really inappropriate sexualized terms.
So that was one of the patterns, and we'll talk about that more, because the information you reveal about the modeling industry is very disturbing. So he went after young women. The other pattern that you uncovered is that he was very aggressive in approaching women, whether it was pinning them against the wall, grabbing part of their body, unwanted advances.
Right. I mean, these are instances that can only be described as assault. You know, whether it be, like you said, pinning somebody against a wall and kissing them, or grabbing somebody's rear end or breast. I mean, there is this sense of entitlement that you see.
You say that, obviously, we need to get this information out and elevate these voices, but this is about so much more than this one man, Donald Trump, who's now in the White House. It's really about a system and institutions that allow this to go on for decades.
Right. I mean, I think Trump is uniquely important in this because of who he – not because of who he is, because of the position he holds. He is an example to men in America and across the globe. But I think it's also important to realize we can go after Weinsteins and Cosbys and Trumps from here to eternity. But until we address the underlying issues, the institutional misogyny, the organizations and systems that allow these things to continue, and the way in which you see men protecting their own and silencing women with accusations, and until all that is addressed and fixed, I believe this will continue to go on.
And the Weinstein trial just ended, and we'll talk about that later in the show. I wonder, as a veteran journalist, why do you think, whether it's R. Kelly, Harvey Weinstein, Jeffrey Epstein, Donald Trump, so many of the men in the media, but in the cases of the first, R. Kelly, Weinstein, and Bill Cosby, reporters did tell their stories, and it never caught on until years and years later.
This is what I'm talking about when I talk about institutions. And I think the media, I hate to say this as a journalist, but I think the media did not always do its job on this either. And we see in, you know, if you read Ronan Farrow's book, we see that NBC was actively silencing these things. And I don't, you know, for one second think they're the only organization that was doing that. I do think that there's a standard that these kinds of stories are held to that needs to be looked at. You know, we have these journalistic standards that I fully believe in. You want things double sourced, you need independent sources, all that, so you make sure you're not being manipulated and that the information you're putting out there is accurate. But when it comes to these kinds of he said, she said stories, by demanding that kind of sourcing, which frankly is impossible if it's two people in a room, what we've done, we've constructed a system in which we are protecting men and their reputations to the detriment of women, who are far more vulnerable. And I think we really need to think about what we're saying with this standard when it comes to allegations of sexual assault.
We did a show recently about the Trump family and how they gained so much wealth. We didn't spend that much time talking about Trump's childhood, but in this case, I think we should, because we don't know much about Donald Trump's mom, Mary, and you don't have that much information in the book, but I think it's interesting. You write that Mary Trump had a very distant relationship with her kids. And Trump, when he does talk about her, praises her because she had the dinner ready, she was a good cook, and when his dad needed to go on business, she didn't complain.
Right, right. She understood that his work was more important, that her role was in the home, and that was a secondary role. And I think that is really crucial in who Trump wound up being, is he grew up in a house that had very strictly gendered roles, even among the kids. You know, the boys and the girls, the brothers and the sisters didn't really play together. The mom kind of took care of the girls. The dad hung out with the boys. And, you know, he has those very kind of archaic, traditional roles being reinforced throughout his childhood. And you see, I mean, he's talked in interviews about, you know, I think after he was divorcing Ivana, he said, you know, if I come home and dinner's not on the table, I hit the roof.
Right. I also didn't know that Mary had complications, Donald Trump's mom, during one of her presidencies, during her pregnancies.
Yeah.
And had to spend a lot of time in the hospital.
Yeah.
So she wasn't there as much when he was very young.
And it was very unexpected, right? That was something that we came across in the research we did. When he was around two, I think he was just shy of 2 years old, his younger brother was born, and his mother had complications. She hemorrhaged after childbirth and had to spend a really long time in the hospital. His sister told a Trump biographer that his dad told them, go to school. If your mother dies, I'll call you, or something like that. I mean, it was incredibly cold. So it was unexpected absence, one for which Trump would not have been prepared. It was at a time in his life when we spoke to several psychiatrists, say that kids are forming their bonds, that it's a really critical moment in a kid's development. And so, I mean, this is all hypothesis, since nobody spoke to Trump directly, and you can't, you know, mental health professionals can't diagnose somebody they've never met, and they won't, rightly. But the hypothesis is that an abrupt rupture at that age would have had a profound effect on his ability to bond with people. And there's one writer who has a theory that Trump developed a detachment disorder because of it. And when you read the symptoms of this detachment disorder, or the sort of ramifications of it and how it affects a person, it really does seem to match up with Trump.
You also write that while Fred Trump, Donald Trump's father, may have been a physical presence in his son's lives, he was emotionally distant from all the children. When the children were struggling with the information that their mom had suffered these complications, as you said, he showed little capacity for comfort. And then his distance from his daughters may have been born out of a general unease around women. Despite his wife giving birth to 5 kids, members of the household were forbidden from uttering the word pregnant.
Right. They were not allowed to say it. And I think that's really interesting, right? There is this kind of discomfort with the realities of a woman's body. And you see that again in the kinds of women that Trump likes, right? Trump really seems to be drawn to the kind of plasticized playboy ideal of a woman's body. And what's interesting is, you know, we know that he likes porn stars, but all his women, the women in his life, have these kind of very, you know, perfect Barbie doll appearances. And what's interesting is that when his wives get pregnant, that's when you see these clusters of, you know, sexual impropriety, affairs. He really doesn't seem to be able to deal with the reality of a woman's body in its natural form.
You said that the cheating actually increased when all of his wives were pregnant.
Yeah. And just to back on this kind of plasticized, sanitized ideal of a woman, he talked on Howard Stern about how one of the things he loved about Melania is that he'd never seen her use the bathroom.
The other thing, I mean, when we talk on the show about, you know, whether it's child abuse or how someone's relationship with their children may affect them as adult, it may not.
Right.
Everyone's
right.
different.
Right.
But you write that The reliance on physical dominance rubbed off on Donald, who exhibited a violent streak from an early age. He threw rocks at the baby next door. He pulled the pigtails of girls in class. He threw cake at birthday parties. He beat up kids in the neighborhood. And as an adult, this belligerence became a point of pride for him.
Right. He was a childhood bully. And this isn't my characterization. It's kind of his own characterization. He boasted about it to biographers and things like that. And, you know, then he went, when he was 13, his father sent him to the New York Military Academy. And the lingua franca there was violence. And he excelled there. And he loved it. And he talks about that. There was, you know, one of the faculty members who was, you know, sort of oversaw them. And he would put kids in the boxing ring. And he was really violent. And Trump said to one of his biographers, you know, the things he did to us now would be illegal. And it was fantastic. And I loved him for it.
You spoke with some of the people that Donald Trump went to school with at the military academy. What really stood out for you?
So there's a guy named Sandy McIntosh who we interviewed, and he talked about how when they were young, because it was an all-boys school, they learned about girls through Playboy magazine. And there was a series that Playboy was running at the time called The Playboy Lifestyle, I think, or something like that. And he said, you know, this was our introduction to women, and this is how we learned to relate to women. He said, and then, you know, most of us got out of school and realized, oh, no, that's not okay, you know, and we grew and we changed, and our understanding of women and how we should relate to them changed and progressed. And he said, and Trump really seems to be stuck in that spot where he was. The other thing he said is that Trump showed absolutely no, in his view, capacity for empathy.
So they're basically saying that Trump is stuck in that 13-year-old
yep.
world.
Yeah, that's exactly what they're saying.
This also says a lot about society, because in this generation, a lot of boys learned about women and sex from Playboy. And now with YouTube, so many boys learn about sex and women through porn online. Yeah. And a lot of it is extremely violent.
Yeah.
And it's very easy to find. I feel like we don't talk about that enough.
No. And it's something that I talk about a lot, because even if you look at the porn of today and older porn, there was a time earlier in my career when I was doing a lot of feminist writing, and I was writing about porn for women, made by women. And so was looking at a fair amount of porn for research reasons. And if you look at the porn of today and the porn then, back then, even sort of heterosexual porn, there was at least a pretend to be concerned with the woman's pleasure. And now the porn is incredibly misogynistic, incredibly violent. It's, you know, rape porn and words that I shouldn't use on the radio. And it is really disturbing that this is how not only young boys are learning about sex, but young girls. And I think girls have lost the idea that they also have a right to have physical pleasure during sex.
Today, we are speaking with Monique Elfasi. She's co-author of the new book, All the President's Women, Donald Trump and the Making of a Predator. The book uncovers 67 accusations of unwanted advances and sexual assault. 12 women share their stories for the very first time. Monique and her co-author, Barry Levine, says this is really the tip of the iceberg, because so many women sign NDA non-disclosure agreements. We talked about that on our show about Trump's wealth and fortune. Everyone in the circle, from the people who work at the hotel to the White House, have to sign these NDAs. But women did talk with them. And if you have any questions about this, we'd love to hear from you. As Monique and Barry write in their book, by June 2019, we had some of this information in the media. News organizations documented as many as 24 women who accused Trump of varying degrees of inappropriate behavior, including sexual harassment or assault. Their investigation found at least 67, and they believe there are far more. You can give us a call at 866-798-8255 if you have any questions about this. Monique and Barry also have a section about Donald Trump's major evangelical support and why they look the other way around all of this, these sexual assaults and predatory behavior. 866-798-8255. You can also email yourcall@kalw.org. With the women, they found patterns and the stories were corroborated. Let's take a caller. Let's go to Greg in Palo Alto. Hi, Greg. Welcome to the show.
You know, a couple of comments, and I know you're not a psychologist or a psychiatrist, I think, but just a couple of issues. One, a lot of this knowledge was available at the time that Trump was running for president. I remember that audio and video clip of him talking to somebody on a bus about what he could do to women. And yet Trump managed to get a fair number of women to vote for him. I've talked to friends of mine about this, women that I know, and I just asked them, how could any woman, having seen that or heard that, actually vote for Trump? So that's one question. The other thing is, this is not uncommon. You can see what's happening over at Berkeley High School right now, where the young girls over there are complaining about sexual harassment on their campus, and they even walked out the other day. And I hate to say it, but I don't think Trump's behavior is unique to Trump. This is widespread among the male population in the United States, I think. And I see teenage boys when I go swimming, lap swimming, there's a huge group of them. And I just got a feeling that they're in this too. I mean, they're not immune from this kind of thing. So thank you for the program.
Thank you, Greg.
So to address the first question about women who supported Trump, I mean, it is sort of baffling, right? It seems like women are working against their own self-interest. But I think if you dig a little bit deeper, and we have a chapter in the book about evangelical support of Trump, because a huge percentage of the women who support Trump are evangelical women. But in broad strokes, the women who supported Trump in the 2016 election were generally women without college degrees, suburban or rural women. And if you think about that, they tend to be women whose status in society is linked to the status of the men in their lives, fathers, husbands. And so when you get a world where men can be challenged and held accountable for their behavior in a way that they hadn't been before, that is scary to women who worry that the men in their lives might suddenly be called out and lose their status, and the women, by extension, will suffer the consequences of that. So in a weird way, there is a certain amount of self-interest. And I also think that, look, there are a lot of reasons women supported Trump. There are a lot of reasons people supported Trump. He spoke to something in America. And I think it's important to recognize that there, there are issues that he managed to, there are issues that people were dealing with in their lives, and Trump managed to convince them that he was going to address them. Whether or not we agree about that, that's what he's doing. People did have legitimate concerns, and those concerns were, they found a savior in Trump. And I think that for those people, they were willing. Trump famously said he could shoot somebody on Fifth Avenue and nobody would care. And I think that I'm not so sure that's an exaggeration. And those people, I spoke to a lot of people who said, oh, the Access Hollywood tape, it was old, or, you know, he didn't really mean it, or they got him out of context, or, you know, people will make incredible excuses for this president.
You also write that in a poll conducted in September 2016 by the Pew Research Center, 76% of evangelicals who supported Trump said their dislike of Hillary Clinton was a major reason they did so. It's tough to overstate how deeply the community abhors Clinton. And you say that Clinton stands for many of the things that evangelicals feel is wrong with the country today, abortion, feminism. But its roots go back to disparaging when she said, quote, I suppose I could have stayed at home and baked cookies. She made this remark when asked about her career during her husband's 92 presidential campaign. And you write, in many ways, Hillary became the embodiment of the culture wars that left evangelicals feeling alienated during Clinton's tenure as a president. And then they blamed his infidelity on her because she wasn't a submissive wife.
Right. I mean, look, the evangelical community, as a lot of the women I spoke to and quoted in the book will say, it is a deeply patriarchal community. And women are supposed to be pretty and submissive and supportive. And Hillary was not submissive or supportive. And they really blamed her. And it was a huge double standard because, you know, in that world, forgiveness is a big thing. And, you know, if a Christian couple went to their pastor, they would likely be, and the husband had cheated on the wife, they would likely be counseled that, you know, God can heal this. There should be forgiveness involved. Hillary did that. She did what they would have counseled her to do, and they held her accountable. They blamed her for it.
Well, thank you for the call, Greg. We're going to take a quick break. Today, we're speaking with veteran journalist Monique Elfasi about her new book, All the President's Women, Donald Trump and the Making of a Predator. The book uncovers 67 accusations of unwanted advances and sexual assault, and 12 women share their stories for the first time. All of these stories have a pattern, and they were all corroborated. This is Your Call. We'll be back after this.
This is Your Call on KALW Local Public Radio. If you have a perspective that you haven't heard in today's discussion or a question that you feel needs to be answered, please contribute to the conversation by calling 866-798-8255. That's 866-798-TALK. You can also send an email to yourcall@klw.org or post a comment or question at the show's website, yourcallradio.org. Tweet us at Your Call Radio. Coming up at 11 on 1A, an experiment being played out in cities across the country. The subject is free public transportation. Supporters believe it can help cut carbon emissions, but more than that, mass transit is a basic need. It does come at a cost, though. Learn more at 1A in 30 minutes at 11 here on KLW.
This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. Coming up tomorrow, it's our Friday Media Roundtable. We will be discussing media coverage of the presidential primaries. If you've got a question or if there's a story that stood out for you, please email us, yourcall@kalw.org. Joining us today is veteran journalist Monique Elfasi, and she is co-author of a new book, All the President's Women, Donald Trump and the Making of a Predator. And if you're just tuning in, I should say that we're discussing topics that are inappropriate for children and might be triggering for some. They uncovered 67 accusations of unwanted advances and sexual assault, and 12 women share their stories for the very first time. These stories share a pattern, and they were corroborated. If you have any questions for Monique, you can give us a call at 866-798-8255. She's also author of God and Country, How Evangelicals Have Become America's New Mainstream. So she's done a lot of research on this topic. Her writing has appeared in a number of publications, including The Guardian, The New York Times, and The Washington Post. You can also email yourcall@kalw.org. Monique, what about Greg's second part of the question about young boys?
I mean, it's a great question. It's a great point. I'm the mother of two teenage boys, so it's something I think about a lot. And I think that is one of the reasons that it matters that we have somebody who talks about women in the way he does in the White House, because young kids look up to the president. That, you know, some of them aspire to be president. And what kind of example does that set when we have a president? Let's even put aside the actions. Just when he talks about women and the disparaging terms that he uses, he objectifies women constantly. That sends a message to young boys, and it's something that I think we all need to think about and address very carefully.
The Washington Post is out with a new piece today called Trump's Words, Bullied Kids, Scarred Schools. The president's rhetoric has changed the way hundreds of children are harassed in American classrooms.
Right, which is devastating. And I actually think you see it even in the political discourse in general. I think that the way, you know, Trump's opponents respond to him has lowered. I think the whole public discourse has been taken to a place that we just don't want it to be.
We have an email from a listener who says, there's a bit of a contradiction because the same men who talk about equality for women are preying on women and girls. How can we raise awareness about institutional misogyny? I was reading about a pedophile in yesterday's New York Times. The support of Mr. Matzneff reflected an enduring French contradiction. A nation that is deeply egalitarian, yet with an elite that often distinguishes itself from ordinary people through a different code of morality, a different set of rules, or at least believing it necessary to defend those who did.
Right. And I mean, that's a whole other thing. I happen to live in France, so I'm watching this play out there. And the whole idea of gender equality has a very different basis in France. But I think that's true. And I think that I actually was surprised to see him face the repercussions that he's faced, because the French have traditionally kind of, it's as the Times story said, had the sort of double standard for intellectuals and, you know, because it has this whole libertine history. So I think that that's a good point. And I think that we often... Look, men in power, I'm going to say white men because we're in the United States, you know, in other parts of the world where the men in power are not white men. Men in power protect themselves. they protect their own. And I think that we saw that with Jeffrey Epstein, who was operating freely in New York. You know, I mean, so many, Bill Cosby, so many of these men, everybody knew what was going on. And nobody did anything about it, largely because the people who could do something about it were part of their club.
Well, and you tell another very disturbing story in the book about these events that would happen. And in one case, Donald Trump was there with four very well-known actors. And the woman who shared this story didn't want to say their names because they're still alive today. And it was basically, I think it was five men and they brought in 50 models.
I think it was Trump. I think it was Trump and three actors.
Okay,
I could be wrong, but yeah.
Okay, maybe four men. And then 50 women were brought in. And the message was basically, we're going to choose which one we want.
Right.
And if you want to go upstairs, great.
Right. And she and so the women were kind of, I mean, it's hard to call them women because some of them were not 18, but and they were sort of in clusters in the room, and the men would come down and talk to them, and our source, Trump, came up to her and spoke to her, and she was from New York, so she knew him and was just like, you know, no. But she said some of these girls who were younger and more naive and unsupervised would go upstairs and come down looking disheveled and looking upset.
I mean, I learned a lot about the modeling community in the book. I guess I just didn't know that 14-year-olds, 13-year-olds from places like Eastern Europe and Japan fly to the United States. They live in New York. They're represented by these agencies, and they are expected to go to dinners and parties with much older men.
Yeah. I mean, one hopes that it's changed, that the stories we write about in the book are, I think, you know, 80s and 90s. One would hope the industry has changed, but yeah, I mean, these young girls are coming over basically unsupervised, and it's a super competitive industry, right? You are up against hundreds of equally pretty young girls. And so you feel compelled to do whatever you have to do to get ahead. And these girls are put into impossible situations. And we talk about sexual assault being a game of power, not a game of power, but being a function of a power discrepancy. I can't think of a bigger power discrepancy than middle-aged millionaires and billionaires and young teenage girls trying to get ahead in a really cutthroat industry.
How is this even allowed, that 14, 15, 16-year-old girls can come to New York from other countries to do this work?
One of the girls, we talk in the book about these content. There was this, so John Casablancas, who was the founder of the Elite Modeling Agency, who was known, you know, I think he married a 16-year-old. He had a relationship with a 15-year-old. He had this contest every year called the Look of the Year. It was a model scouting contest. And a lot of the girls that we did, Trump sponsored it twice. So they were, the girls were housed in Trump properties. One year he was a judge. Parties were on, you know, the Trump yacht one year. And one of the girls that we talked to said that her roommate was a 12-year-old Japanese girl who was completely unsupervised. I mean, these girls are, it's you know, they're prey. They're sitting ducks for these guys.
You write that according to interviews conducted for the book with dozens of people in the modeling world who are familiar with Trump's behavior, he had a reputation for never missing an opportunity to meet models. Someone said he was a predator. Absolutely. He was always chasing models. You know, he's a big guy. He's 6'3", 6'4", self-confident in one way to describe him, or wolf is another. He was really aggressive. And many of these girls were no match for him because you're talking about 16 or 17 year olds who are starstruck. They're in New York. As you said, it's very competitive.
Right. And they think that, you know, being nice to a guy like that is going to help them get ahead, that he's going to somehow then do them a favor and put a good word in for them. And they don't realize that they are just completely interchangeable.
You write, Trump was a germaphobe, and he allegedly made sure models had a clean bill of health before he hooked up with them. He would sometimes call a friend at one of the agencies and ask him to send specific girls to see his doctor so he could make sure they didn't have STDs.
Yeah. Yeah. And he talked on the Leonard Stern show. He talked about
Howard Stern.
Thank you very much. The Howard Stern show. Howard Stern show. He talked about that the 80s were his own personal Vietnam, that he felt that surviving that decade without getting an STD was like surviving a war.
Wow. One person also said that if you're over 21, you don't have to worry, because he preferred young girls.
Right.
Today we're speaking with Monique Elfasi about her important and disturbing new book, All the President's Women, Donald Trump and the Making of a Predator. Monique is a longtime journalist. She's also author of God and Country, How Evangelicals Have Become America's New Mainstream. And you can join us at 866-798-8255. The book is just full of stories. In fact, at the end of the book, there's an appendix, and it's basically short paragraphs of all of the women who say that they were assaulted by Donald Trump or were at the receiving end of very aggressive, unwanted advances. Let's go to another caller, Robert in San Francisco. Hi, Robert. Welcome to the show.
Thank you for letting me speak, Rose. I just want to add a note of caution to this broadcast, because the way Trump has been successful is to set people up against each other. You have one side versus another. Everyone's right. Everyone's wrong. This is yes and it's no. It's an absolutes. And the one thing that hurts Trump in what he's trying to accomplish is a dialogue. That whatever people get from or learn from reading this kind of material or hearing the show is that it's not you have to set up camps and abandon all hope, as the dialogue needs to be kept open and there is a path forward.
I think that's a really good point. And to that point, one of the things that I tried very hard to do in this book, that Barry and I both tried hard to do, was to talk to people who had nice things to say about Trump. Talk to the women who had positive experiences with him. And, you know, we talked to Paula White, his personal pastor. And in one of our early appearances we did together, Barry and me, a young woman in the audience said, "Are you worried about humanizing Trump by including these kinds of stories?" And I said, "No, the opposite. I want to humanize him. He is a real person, and he is a complicated person like all of us are. And it is not all black and white, and he is not always evil." And I think that's a really good point that you bring. I think the polarization of America comes from this inability to see anything positive in the other side and to acknowledge that life is often gray and things are complicated. So thank you very much for bringing that point up.
Well, thank you for calling, Robert. I think it's a good point, because on this show, no matter what we're talking about, you know, violent crime, we try to find out, well, who is this person? What was their childhood like? What was their, community like? Where did they have access to food? Did they live in dire poverty? And on this side, you've got a very privileged man who, as we are learning, unfortunately, sadly, his mom had complications during pregnancy. He lived in a household where the mom was cooking and the father was in charge.
Right.
So, you know, what if he had been raised in a different kind of family?
Right. Who would he have been then? Right. And what's interesting, we felt like there was this sliding doors moment that he had when he married Ivana, and they had these three kids and they seemed to be on top of the world with the real estate empire. You know, he could have gone in a different direction. He was this family man and he was, you know, ascendant in New York. And it seemed as though he could have been a different person.
Hmm. Well, thank you for that call, Robert. We have another email. Let's see. Joan says, "Speaking of bathrooms and Melania, remember when Trump mocked Hillary for needing a bathroom break?" I actually forgot all about that.
Yes, I don't know.
When he said it was disgusting, right?
Right. And that's part of the, you know, he cannot stand female bodily functions. There's another story in the book about there was a lawyer who was in some sort of deposition with him and needed to take a break to pump breast milk. She had a newborn, a young infant, and he flipped out. You know, he really is uncomfortable with bodily functions. Mm.
We have another question about his childhood from Sandy. How far back does the author go? It's reported that Trump was sent to military school because his family couldn't control him. Was he also sent away because of sexual aggressiveness?
I mean, he was 13. So we do have the military academy episode in the book. He was 13. Actually, nobody knows why he was sent away. His own best friend, a guy named Peter Brandt, we quote in the book, who was Trump's best friend at the time, just found out one day Trump was leaving. Nobody outside of that family knows why he was sent away. We can hypothesize that it was because Trump was, you know, bullying and out of control, and the father wanted him, you know, the father comes from a German background, a pretty regimented background, that he wanted him brought under control. But that is complete hypothesis. We interviewed a lot of people. It's a conclusion drawn on the interviews we did. But short of asking his father, we can't know for certain.
And you did try to interview Trump and his inner circle.
We tried to interview everybody.
And yeah. No one would talk to
no.
you.
No. And we made multiple attempts to get in touch with the White House and FedEx things and emailed things and, you know, made multiple phone calls. They would not comment.
Today we're speaking with veteran journalist Monique Elfazi. She's co-author of the new book, All the President's Women, Donald Trump and the Making of a Predator. What can you tell us about Trump's relationship with Jeffrey Epstein? We've seen the photos of him with Epstein. And I mentioned the story in the book. It was actually model Heather Braden who talked about an alleged blacklist in New York that men had to spend thousands of dollars where they were accepted and vetted, and then would grant them access to having sex with young models. And this was the same circle that Epstein was in.
Yeah, I mean, to be clear, nobody told us that Epstein had access to that list. I'm not even sure he needed it. He had his own thing going on. Trump denies being friends with Epstein. There are myriad photos of them together. I personally know people who were on, a Trump plane and Epstein plane together with both of them. I mean, it is well documented that they had a relationship. Were they friends? I don't know. Did they spend time together? Was Epstein at Mar-a-Lago? Yes. Did Trump go to Epstein's mansion? There are reports that he did. But there is, as I alluded to earlier, there is a lawsuit. It was withdrawn. It was actually filed and withdrawn multiple times by a woman, a Jane Doe, who goes under the pseudonym Katie Johnson, who alleges that she was at Epstein's mansion in New York when she was 13. She had sexual contact with Trump multiple times over the course of a summer, and the last time he raped her violently.
The lawsuit was withdrawn, refiled, and then withdrawn, and her lawyer said she received death threats and was too afraid.
Right. So she had a press conference scheduled, and right before the press conference, she backed out and her lawyer said she's been getting death threats. She's afraid to come forward. And I think we've seen that with powerful men, not just Trump, but with Weinstein, women, they do not benefit from coming forward. You know, I hear this all the time, where they're doing it for the money. They're in it for the fame and the money. And it is almost to a woman, their lives are not better off for having come forward. And, these men are powerful men with very deep pockets. And it's frightening and dangerous for women.
Katie Johnson's a memo about her was sent to special counsel Robert Mueller during the investigation about Trump. Whatever happened with that? And do we know what happened with Katie Johnson?
No, I mean, she's disappeared as far as we know. I mean, she's still sort of around. There is this kind of, there's a circle of people who've been trying to get her story out that email journalists and things, but she's gone underground. Nobody knows where she is. I mean, I'm sure some people do. And yeah, I mean, that just really was hushed up. And I think there are probably a lot of women like her. I mean, I personally know Epstein victims who, never came forward publicly.
Wow. I was just thinking about Christine Blasey Ford.
Well, I mean, she's a perfect example. I read an article recently that said she still, I think, hasn't returned to her home or still is in hiding. I can't remember what it was, but she still has not been able to resume her normal life.
She was just honored at a fundraiser hosted by Futures Without Violence. It was her second appearance. And she said, ultimately, I decided I did owe it to the citizenry of this country, to future generations, and to other people to share this information.
It was incredibly brave of her, but it drives me crazy when people say she did it to be self. It was self-serving. There was nothing self-serving about it. It destroyed, whether or not you believe her, one must at least acknowledge that her life is not better for having come forward.
And then you mentioned Karen Johnson, the woman who said that Trump groped her at a Mar-a-Lago New Year's Eve party, and Melania was in a different room. She said she didn't want to come forward because she was a dancer in the past, and she thought that would haunt her. And this is this has happened in the Weinstein case.
One of the things that was really heartbreaking for me in doing this, I would read the transcripts of these women, the interviews with these women, and almost all of them at some point said, what I wondered, was I wearing the wrong skirt? I stopped wearing short skirts. What kind of attitude was I putting off? Did I seem stupid? And they almost all look to themselves for responsibility. And when you look at this work in the aggregate, when you look at these encounters in the aggregate and you see the patterns that emerge, you realize it has almost nothing to do with the women themselves. If it wasn't one woman, it would have been the other woman standing there. And it was really sad for me to see how many of these women blamed themselves and carried that feeling of culpability around with them for decades.
Decades.
Yeah.
The character assassination is really effective.
Right. It really is. And, we have been taught as women that, what were you wearing? Society teaches us that, women put something out there and men are powerless to resist it.
Monique Alfasi is co-author of All the President's Women, Donald Trump and the Making of a Predator. Let's go to another caller, Lisa in San Francisco. Hi, Lisa. Welcome to the show.
Hi. Yes, I'm very happy that you are exposing the most disgusting person on the planet, as far as I'm concerned, Donald Trump. But I also take issue with how you portrayed Hillary Clinton as representing something that I, as a woman, do not identify with at all. In particular, her stint as Secretary of State was very warlike, and in fact has put a lot of women in Honduras, in particular, and in Central America, in danger, such as Berta Cáceres, for example. But also, she represents somewhat the Clinton administration in the privatization of, for example, the Telecommunications Act, allowed for the media conglomerates to form and allowed for the proliferation of all these evangelical radio stations throughout the country, as well as the Welfare Reform Act, which has placed women in very dangerous situations in their jobs where they can't go back to getting welfare after 5 years, and also the immigrant reform, even though she did support the Woman Against Violence Act, the immigration reform that Clinton, her husband, put forward.
And Lisa, sorry to cut you off. We're almost out of time. We've done shows about all of that. I don't want to speak for you, Monique, but you were specifically talking about Hillary and Bill Clinton's infidelity and how evangelicals
saw
it.
Yeah, but I will say one thing, though. I think it's important to remember that this is not intended to be a partisan book. And I believe that men should be held accountable for their actions with women, regardless of what side of the fence they're on or what side of the aisle they're on. And I think that, you know, Clinton needed to be held accountable, too.
Right. Well, thank you for calling, Lisa. And I completely understand the point. We've done so many shows about those points. As we enter 2020, how do you think the media should deal with this? Because as you have said in many interviews and in the book, you just feel like the media did not give these women their say. I mean, Donald Trump, as you write in the book, we didn't talk about this much, but he learned from lawyer Roy Cohn to fight back really hard and just to call them liars.
Right. And yeah, what's interesting about that, there are two points I'll make. What's interesting about that is because the statutes of limitations involving crimes against women are generally short, many, many women who may like to press charges now are unable to. And two of the women that have allegations against the president, Summer Zervos, who was a contestant on The Apprentice, and E. Jean Carroll, who was the Elle magazine advice columnist who alleges that he raped her in a dressing room in Bergdorf Goodman in New York City. What they have done is they have sued Trump for defamation after he calls them liars. So he does call them liars. Women are now finding a way to fight back against that, which I find, you know, interesting and heartening. I can't remember what the rest of the question was.
Just what you expect from the media this year, especially
We're at such a different time, and yet I think that we need to acknowledge that, again, that women are silenced, and the media is part of that, powerful men are part of that, that as brave as these women are to come forward, there are so many that are afraid to, and even the ones that do are not given a fair hearing. And it's what I talked about before, too. You know, these are by definition he said, she said stories. And somehow we err on the side of protecting the men who are being accused. And these are the men who are in power. You know, why are we not protecting the most vulnerable members of our society in these instances?
Janelle wants to know, what have you received any pushback? Do you feel like you're in any, well, she used the word danger.
I don't feel like I'm in danger. I also am lucky in that, or lucky, I think I'm protected in that I don't live in this country. I get emails from people telling me these are all lies and how dare I do this. But that I think is to be expected too. And you know what? That's part of living in a democracy. I don't need everybody to agree with us. And, you know, we did our best to put together a journalistic body of work, and we are not trying to convince anybody of anything. We just really felt that it is important that these stories be on the record.
What about young men? You said you have two young boys. What do you think? How do you think we should better talk to young boys about these issues?
I think, you know, one of the things I think is very important is to teach young boys that their perception can differ from the perception of any woman or girl that they're involved with. I'm now talking specifically about sexual allegations. There was a video that that was circulating on social media of a man, I think it was right after the Women's March, who said, I want to apologize to the women that I've known. I realize now that I may have had encounters with women that did not feel consensual to them, that I thought were consensual. And I think that's really, really important that we talk to boys about consent, and not just about consent, but also about coercion.
I think that there was a hashtag around that issue where a lot of men went on Twitter and apologized.
Yeah. And I think that I find that incredibly heartening. I think, look, I don't think all these kinds of stories involve men with bad intentions. I think also sometimes there's ignorance and a lack of awareness and a lack of sensitivity. And I think we just need to educate boys and girls. Girls need to learn to say, I'm not comfortable. And boys need to listen to that. And boys also, again, need to be mindful, not just about consent, but about not being coercive.
Where does this story go from here? Oh, you know, the one other thing I wondered, I just reading about Trump cheating on all of his wives, especially when they were pregnant, and going through this cycle of going after young girls, and he even started his own modeling agency, mm-hmm. so he had access to all of these young girls, and then going after porn stars and going to all these clubs right when his kids were born. Is he still doing this today?
We have heard stories that he is. Can I confirm them? No. But look, this is these are patterns of behavior that have existed for decades and decades and decades and decades. Is it logical to believe that it stopped one day because he switched addresses? You know, we wanted to track down those stories. We didn't have time to, and there are complicated issues. But I find, look, I think history repeats itself, and I think it defies logic to believe that one day it all just stopped.
Are you going to pursue any of that, or is Barry?
You know, there's Barry May. Yeah, there's. I mean, right now Barry's on another book, but it's, you know, we're still pursuing leads that come into us. Yes.
Final thoughts, Monique. What would you like to see changed in the media? Because the media are so powerful, especially on this issue.
Look, I think that the reckoning that has happened around Me Too is a good step forward. But I really believe that nothing will change definitively until we change who's controlling the levers of power. And that means that 50% of boardrooms need to be occupied by women. That means 50% of C-suites need to be occupied by women. And that means 50% or 51% of the seats in Congress need to be occupied by women.
And it has to be a woman who believes that women should tell their stories, because Weinstein's lawyers are women.
Yeah, look, I mean, that's another thing. But let's get women in there, and then we can worry about who these women are.
Right.
But, you know, I don't think they need to necessarily be women who mirror us. I think really we just need women. I think that's step one.
Monique Elfasi is a veteran journalist and co-author of All the President's Women, Donald Trump and the Making of a Predator. Monique is also author of God and Country, How Evangelicals Have Become America's New Mainstream. Thank you for your work, and thank you for coming in.
Thank you so much for having me.
Thank you. Thanks to Leah Cesarine for producing today's show, and David Latulipe, our studio engineer. Thank you for joining us. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's your call.